tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Welcome to Shift Drink on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I'm Eddie Kim, proud DCist, Riesling apologist, and amateur morning person.
And I'm Matthew Ramsey, Wile E. Coyote, cheeseburger life coach, and ice cream pirate. Every week we share a Shift Drink and swap war stories from behind the line with chefs, bartenders, bakers, brewers, and anyone who touches this all-encompassing industry. We were on yesterday and we began our season 5
with bang bang episodes of podcast.
A little rusty, but we're back in the saddle again.
we downed the intro. Oh great, first 5 minutes down.
And this week we are joined by John Binet, senior contributing editor for Punch, online magazine, former wine editor for the San Francisco Chronicle, and author of The New California Wine and The New Wine Rules, and all around talking head in wine world. Apparently, we were just talking about, I still use his pizza dough recipe that I
learned. That's the first thing that you came up
about 10 years
thought
ago.
About John.
My great contribution to the world.
Yeah, welcome, John. How are you?
Great. How are you guys doing?
Can I ask what was special about that pizza dough recipe?
It was the attempt to bring in a lot of Chris Bianco, a lot of a Pizza Shoals in Portland, and combine it with Peter Reinhardt's kind of work on volumes and weights. And so it was actually the original recipe, which we then retrofitted, was all weight-based. Because when you're doing hydration rates, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, so it was sort of boiling all that down into measures that people could use without thinking too much. And it seems to still be working.
So. Yeah, it does. I was just out of culinary school doing my externship at the Chronicle, and I was very excited about
being
that.
Subjected to all of the sometimes working, sometimes not recipes that everyone dreamed of.
Matthew, did you have a mustache back then?
No mustache back then.
I believe he had a soul patch and a puka necklace.
Probably.
It was California.
It's California, exactly. Exactly. Well, before we dig into it, let's do a little weekend recap, shall we?
Sure. Something that happened during our long break, with a little bit of a spat between the New York Times and, I guess, everyone who loves Aperol spritzes, which, it was just a trolling article. I feel like it was real clickbait. And then a lot of people came to the defense of the Aperol spritz.
Yeah, it was. I definitely took the bait.
John, are
people
you
who they're fine. Yeah. But people who I, you know, like grandparents and in-laws and people who never in the world would otherwise have tried an Aperol spritz were suddenly trying it. So, in the course of what we used to call a slate pitch, because the online magazine Slate used to come up with these preposterous stories, which were clearly just clickbait.
Right.
And so, literally, you would just, if it was something so stupid. That you couldn't imagine an editor would have ever done it non-ironically. It was a slate pitch, and that was for sure a slate pitch.
Yeah.
they ended up giving Aperol a whole bunch of free advertising.
So. Yeah, I mean, that's no bad press, right? Mexican-born New York chef Daniela Soto Inez has just been named the world's best female chef at the age of 28. It's weird that there's a category for female chef, but it's definitely an accomplishment that she's so widely recognized.
Yeah, it is weird that they have a category for that. Didn't get rid of it.
But, yeah. John, have you been to Cosme?
I have. It's delicious.
Yeah. I'm a huge fan of Oliveira.
I guess it's some kind of small award ceremony. You know, Jimmy Beard happened in Chicago.
It's just Jim. To his
oh,
friends.
Jim yeah. Beard. Number of DC chefs got the medal, the James Beard medal around their neck this time around. Tom Cunanan for Best Mid-Atlantic Chef, Kwame Onwuachi for Rising Star Chef, and in a very heartfelt speech, I know I cried when I was listening to it, Patrick O'Connell for, it was just like a Lifetime Achievement Award for his work over at the Inn at Little Washington.
So a lot to celebrate. Mm-hmm. All right, let's cut to it. We're drinking already. It's 1 o'clock in the afternoon on a Tuesday. I was pleasantly surprised, John, that you, one of the leading American voices writing on wine, requested mezcal.
I need energy.
Yeah,
it was mezcal.
Like I got a long train ride. You know, yeah. I need agave to bring me through the afternoon.
Actually, I don't think you said it was weird. I don't think it was that weird. I feel a lot of my wine friends.
Love mezcal.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I guess as to why, if there are any threads of continuity between the two, but why
I mean, I find it delicious, but yeah, there is. I mean, it is still one of the few truly artisan beverages left in the real meaning of that word. It is still all really small production. It is still very terroir driven, and there is distinction between villages, between highlands and lowlands. There is an expressiveness to it. So yeah, I mean, I think it sort of, you know, touches all the same nerve centers as wine does.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That's
except again, wine makes you like a little tired, and mezcal it's literally the energy drink.
Right. It has mescaline.
Yeah.
But no, that's exactly what I find so interesting about it. And they talk about, you know, the hand of the mescalero, and just, you see that a lot with wine too, and how the producer can totally, you know, bend a varietal to his or to their means. So this is Bozal Mezcal. It's an ensemble of Espadin, Barril, and Mexicano.
Excellent pronunciation.
Oh, thank you.
I know you're practicing that in the car right over.
Listen, I don't have a car anymore.
Oh,
big season 5 change. I no longer commute via car.
Yes, because you lost your door.
I have a moped that looks like a motorcycle. It has like basically the engine of a leaf blower, but.
If you see a garishly dressed man with a mustache and a helmet, is that a shark head? I can't tell.
Ah, okay. It's up for debate.
Please be careful around him. He's precious cargo.
John, do you tend to lean toward, are there certain varietals of agave that you lean into?
No, I'm blessedly in. I don't want to say the exploratory phase because I've been drinking it too long now, but it's just, you know, all things are lovely. Probably a little bit of Highlands. I mean, there was back when Del Maguey was sort of the benchmark. They had one village that was, I believe it was Santo Domingo de Alvarado, and I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that, but this is the one thing. You drink mezcal, your memory gets fuzzy.
That's right.
But it was a very, very high elevation, kind of in a cloud forest, single village, single variety. I think it was Espadin again, all fuzzy. Mm-hmm. And it really, I at some point, probably not, you know, not winning any friends in the mezcal world, said it was the red burgundy of mezcal, and that it was all about subtlety and nuance and soft brush strokes.
Yeah.
And so, you know, things come, but it's, I'm still in that pleasant place where I get to just be, curious and drink it all.
Yeah.
Have you spent much time in Mexico?
No. No, it's been a long time.
What about the wines there?
Oh, good question.
Work in progress.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. They're getting there slowly. It's not a culture that, not meaning Mexico, but the Mexican wine industry specifically has been kind of like where, let's say, I was going to say Paso Robles, but that's not really right. Let's say like the Finger Lakes has been, in that they're just kind of happy to be making wine. They like the tourism part. They like hosting people, but there's just never been a push to have really high quality winemaking until recently. And so it's still really early on that curve.
Sure.
And moving beyond just like taking money from people who go to Baja. And so Not that there's anything wrong with that, but it doesn't. I mean, you know, generally the desire to ply tourist dollars has not equated to great wine.
Yeah.
And so it's getting there, you know, and then there's like a little tiny naturalist contingent with Bichy.
Which means naked.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Okay. Of course it does. It's natural.
Stop yelling at the top of my lungs.
Yeah. But you know, there's a little bit of progress, but it's just it's hard because export is difficult. Figuring out the markets are difficult. It's, you know, just certainly right now, given current politics, Mexican wine is probably not the first thing I would try to sell as an importer. So it'll, you know, it'll come along, but I think it's, I think that it's not, I think it's going to struggle for attention for a while, in part because, you know, because so many people have built great mezcal programs.
Yeah.
I mean, but since there's a huge explosion of, you know, Latin American and Mexican and South American cuisine here in America, in D.C., we're about to open La Coseca, which is, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, is like basically a food hall full of Latin American.
Latin market, yeah.
Yeah. Wouldn't that imply, hopefully?
But the thing is that the wine culture there has never particularly dovetailed with the culinary culture. It's starting. But it's not like there was a tradition. I mean, if you went back to like the old German immigrants a century ago, but there wasn't really, or isn't really, hasn't been a tradition of drinking a ton of wine with food in Mexico. Yeah. It's not something indigenous to the culture particularly. And so I think you see, I mean, Cosme is a good example, but there's lots of them where people who are really doing the top-notch Mexican cooking in the United States are developing great wine programs in addition to cocktail and mezcal and everything else, but they're not particularly focused. I mean, they're not thinking, oh, I have to add Mexican wine. They might have a couple because, again, there's only a handful even here. But I think they're seeing that there's correspondences that are just as good, if not better, with wines from the Loire or wines from northern Italy or maybe Georgia, maybe Galicia. And I think... honestly, if you go to Central or South America, where what you see predominantly is Spanish and then South American wine.
Right.
Definitely hold that thought because I'm going to pick your brain about that in another context, a whole different continent. But I think now is the time that we should play a little bit of a game that you like to play. A
little icebreaker we call Two Truths, One Lie.
Two Truths, One Lie.
John, I'm guessing you're familiar with this game.
I am now.
Yeah. A little pre-game familiarization.
Pretty self-explanatory. Basically, you're gonna tell three things to Eddie and myself, one of which is a lie and two of which are true. And Eddie and I are going to figure out what is not real. Lie to us.
All right. Number one, I'm a pilot.
Oh.
Number two, I am actually a Canadian citizen.
Interesting.
And number three, I once wrote a story about men, I don't know if you can say this on podcasts, about men regrowing their foreskins.
Oh, you definitely cannot say that. That's amazing.
French Canadian?
It's possible.
Hey, what? We're allowed to ask questions.
No follow-up questions. All right. Canadian. I feel like you were born in New York. This is my understanding of you. Pilot, I think the foreskin's true.
Yeah. He did write in San Francisco.
Yeah.
is that the benchmark?
I'm just going out.
You're a writer in San Francisco. You clearly cover that.
Everything.
Yeah. Sooner or later, you're going to write about foreskin.
Yeah. I mean, if it happens in De Castro. Speaking of San Francisco, Anna's there, native San Franciscan.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, Anna. I'm going to say that you're deathly afraid of flying, so you're not a pilot.
Yeah.
But that's like something, gut reaction.
I'll follow that later. I think it's, yeah. I think you're Canadian. And
I am not Canadian. I am German, but I hold dual citizenship. I am not Canadian.
German and American citizenship.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Okay. But you are a pilot.
I am a pilot.
That's cool.
It's been a while, but...
How long have you been navigating the friendly skies?
I got my certificate in 2003.
Oh, wow.
No, it was 2003. February 2003.
Do you get to utilize this? I mean, were you flying out to vineyards in Sonoma? And...
Not really. I did. I was flying for a few years in San Francisco. I'd fly out of Oakland and would sometimes go up to wine country, but it's not really particularly right. effective as a way to get up there. And it's also very expensive to fly in the Bay Area, so I stopped. It's also even more expensive to fly in New York, so waiting to move to a small town somewhere and start it up again. But no, I learned to fly in Seattle.
Ah, cool.
And, which is kind of the perfect place because you could just, you know, I'd start work early, I'd get off of work early, and I'd just, like, you know, go kick off to the San Juans for the afternoon.
If there's anything I learned from watching all 16 seasons of Grey's Anatomy,
yes,
is that flying anything in Seattle is a dangerous hobby. Or just traveling in general, trains, planes, automobiles.
It's on TV, it must be true.
Yeah.
It was actually kind of the perfect place. Again, one, because it's gorgeous, but two, because you have real weather there. So all the flight schools are always in Florida and Arizona and so on. But if you learn to fly in Seattle, you're actually learning weather. So I became really good at understanding meteorological reports.
Cool.
Because you are... You have rain,
right?
And, which doesn't stop you, but the clouds will, and so you have to be very good at understanding what's happening, where things are happening, weather patterns,
and that must go hand in hand with your wine expertise.
It certainly helped. It's like Groundhog Day, where the woman at the B&B is trying to make small talk with Bill Murray's character, and she makes some comment about the weather, and he goes off on a long tangent about the front coming in, et cetera. And he's like, did you really want to talk about the weather, or are you just making conversation?
Right. and you're telling me that foreskin regrowth is a real thing.
It was. I think it's still lurking out there somewhere on the internet, as all things do. But yeah, it was. It was a real thing. It was actually based in San Francisco, although I was in Seattle at the time when I was reporting it. And our health editor at MSNBC wanted, they were doing a package on men's sexual health. And I was like, well, I don't really want to contribute to this. And yeah. I was like, all right, let me see if I can find a topic, and came back with that. And, you know, if you want to see an editorial meeting, get real quiet.
Public service announcement. I believe it is Men's Health Month, so everyone should get the prostate exam.
Okay. So you were in town. You're in town for a discussion on the intersection of taste and identity that happened last night.
For sure.
At the public library and domestic wine. It was really interesting, and there's a lot of unique perspectives out there or on the panel. One thing I found interesting in your discussion last night was that the older and more experienced you become, the kind of more curious and willing you ought to kind of sort of break out of those conventional standards.
Well, that's in my case, Lee Campbell and I. Lee is a very, very talented wine director and consultant in New York who worked for a long time for Andrew Tarlow's kind of hotel restaurant empire. But so she was saying that she finds that her, I don't want to say her tastes are narrowed, but she finds that she kind of goes back to more comfortable tastes with time. She and I are about the same age. And I was saying, for me, it's been the complete opposite. I find I want to explore more, and I have moments where I want to go back to references, but I find that I like just kind of exploring and discovering all the new stuff out there, in part because, for me at least, the momentum of the drinks world generally, but certainly of the wine world, has like doubled or tripled in the past 10, 15 years, and things are moving so fast and so kind of wildly and curiously. Some of that is good, some of that is bad, but it's the fact that there is this constant push to move away from this very narrow set of traditions, I think, is important. And that always has defined wine, as much as we like to think that it's this cultural anchor. Emile Pinault, who was the great Bordeaux enologist, his quote that I am probably slightly misquoting was that tradition is an experiment that worked. And
right. That's good.
And so I think, you know, what you're seeing now is that everyone is experimenting, and there are things like Pet Nat is a good example, Orange Wine is a good example, that we talked about as weird, freaky curiosities 5 or 10 years ago, and now they've become part of the canon. And so I'm like, you know, I just think if you want to be, if you really love wine right now, you just have to be open to everything that comes along.
Well, to some extent, a lot of this, a lot of the resurgence of Pet Nats and natural wines, I mean, they have been made traditionally, just kind of in the back of the barn.
For sure.
Like, hidden away.
I think the thing that you see now is that it's not simply replicating the tradition. So let's take skin fermented wines, orange wines. So that came back really in Friuli in northern Italy, mostly with a Friulian set of grapes, Rivola Gialla, Sauvignon Blanc, with Jasko Grosvenor, with Radicon, et cetera. It was a very specific tradition. And they, to some extent, were trying to pay homage to the tradition in Georgia, which, again, was a very specific tradition. But now you see the technique has become part of the canon, and people are trying it everywhere. And some of it works, some of it doesn't. But I wanted to talk about this a little last night, and we didn't have quite of time during the discussion. But one of the things that I really have fallen in love with in wine that's really kind of weird and on the fringe is skin-fermented Gewürztraminer from Alsace. And Alsatian wines have a million problems right now. They're not in their most interesting place ever. But one of the things that really is happening there is that, you know, a handful of folks have decided that Gewürztraminer, which was always kind of this sweet, you know, flourishy, muscatty and substantial wine, that it does have great texture in the skins, and if you make it like an orange wine, it's this completely different thing. And it's strange and compelling, and we're talking about sort of matching things up. It's one of these great things that goes with especially like Isan flavors, when you get heavy lemongrass and you get heavy spice, and you don't just need that sweetness, but you need a density to the texture. And here's this thing that, you know, 10, 15 years ago was unimaginable.
Well, I mean, I hope it's commonplace now that a lot of Southeast Asian flavors, big spicy bombs, do pair up well with a slightly sweeter Riesling and Gewürztraminers and
yeah, although
but now if you make the skin fermented versions of the Gewürztraminer still pair up well with those foods.
Well, it's interesting. Back in like 2007 at the Chronicle, you remember Olivia Wu?
Yeah.
My colleague Olivia and I decided to do this wine pairing guide for Thai food, mostly because we were pissed off that the answer that wine people and food people that everyone would give you was, oh, just get some Gewürztraminer, which doesn't really go very well with most Thai food because the sweetness, it's a low acid grape. And right. So if you're looking at the actual traditional balance, you need high acid and residual sugar and something to replicate the vegetal flourish that's between herbs, lemongrass, ginger. You need something that gives you an echo. And so Gewürztraminer was this very imperfect thing, but people in this sort of lazy Western way were like, oh, just Gewürztraminer or a beer. And so we decided to knock that all down with a wrecking ball. And so it's interesting, Gewürztraminer in its like traditional form doesn't really work for me that well, but when you make it in this totally different way, suddenly it goes to a place that I do find a correspondence versus something like Riesling, where the intense acidity of it does tend to find better correlation.
Do you think, I mean, is this comparable to what we saw with the beer world and even cocktails where we're leaning into this craft thing? I mean, with Pet Nat and natural winemaking coming back and kind of we're basically celebrating the artisan nature of it again.
Yeah. One of the columns I wrote before I left San Francisco, let's say to late 2014 or so, maybe early 15, was about how wine had finally started emulating the craft beer world, and that was actually great. And I called it the freestyle era, which is to say craft beer was sort of going beyond IPAs into all these other crazy things. And this is when sours were coming up and people were doing more wild ferments and suddenly getting into saisons. And you could see that, especially on the West Coast, where it was like IPA and only IPA for about 10 or 15 years, suddenly you'd walk into Michelob Bar in San Francisco and you'd find all these like 22-year-olds who are drinking crazy sours.
Right.
And I was like, well, that's amazing. And, you know, and frankly, wine is just starting to get to that point where you don't have to make the same wine every year. You don't have to just repeat yourself. And obviously, by definition, you're on a different timeline because you only get one harvest a year. It's
right.
not like you wake up as a brewery and you decide you're going to make another batch. But to speed up that timeline and to not just make it, I'm going to make the same six wines over and over again, was such a crucial thing in wine breaking out of its old place.
I feel like we've gone to the point where beer went to the point where we had these massive swings from one direction to another for these, you know, defects in what we consider defects in beers. And hasn't that already happened in wine? And then now we're kind of coming back to a middle ground. We're realizing, you know,
I keep waiting for us to get back to the middle ground in wine. I don't know. Per our discussion last night, are there flaws anymore?
You're right.
I'm so not opening that door.
Open the door because Eddie wanted to talk about mousiness in wine.
Yeah. Oh, let's talk about mousiness.
Okay, so a friend.
We talked a lot about mousiness on the other side of the lobby over a lot of rum last night.
Oh, nice.
Oh, great. And rum actually has this good amount of mousiness to it. Actually, our the person who, Jeffrey, who composed our intro music, he... huge natural wine nut, wanted me to ask this question to you. Is, well, what was the question? It was find it. What are good tricks to figure out what if something is mousy, and what is mousy actually in your opinion?
That is complicated. So. <Yeah. laughs> So what is mousy? Mousy is still something that we're trying to figure out, but it is seemingly related to lactic acid fermentation and the point at which it comes. And so it's, I have long, long notes with the science about this, none of which I remember right now. But it is something that tends to go off during the fermentation process. Sometimes if, say, malolactic fermentation starts before, but not necessarily. But clearly it's something that can happen when there's some sort of bacteria that is in the wine that doesn't get knocked out by a small amount of sulfur. The thing that's really interesting is it seems to, again, these are never hard and fast because no one's really done hard research. It seems to be somewhat related to early bottling, which is to say...
Like early in the season?
Say if you're bottling like in the spring. So this is why one of the reasons I think, well, aside from them not using sulfur, one of the reasons I think it tends to be more prevalent in natural wines is that a lot of natural wines are bottled very, very early. They're bottled before the following summer.
Gotcha.
And so it's conceivable that there are wines that might otherwise show mousiness biochemically, it works itself out in the course of élevage, in the course of aging. But when you bottle it early, you're trapping in the bottle whatever it is. And it's, again, you know, people will fight about this constantly because it's almost all anecdotal, but it does seem more often than not, most typically, to go away with even a homeopathic dose of sulfur at bottling, which is simply to say that whatever the microbes that are causing it, that finding a way to kill them off will nullify it. In terms of how to identify it, that's where it's really tricky because, again, there's no hard and fast numbers, but somewhere between, let's approximately 30 to 40% of the population doesn't have the mouth chemistry to be able to taste it.
Huh.
So it's a little like I have the cilantro thing where cilantro tastes like soap to me. I've made my peace with it and I just like power through, but it tastes like soap. And so it's like it's a little like that, but I think even more pronounced where we were talking about this last night, where there are clearly natural wine buyers and natural wine importers who cannot taste mouse. And so this flaw that to me tastes sort of like somewhere, I mean, it tastes like death. But it sort of tastes like somewhere between like wet cornflakes and like the bottom of a mouse cage.
So that was the exact question I wanted to ask next. Yeah. Was like, what is mousiness? Yeah. Like,
it's this very, I mean, people describe it in different ways. To me, it's this very mealy, kind of sort of stale, dead tasting aspect that comes retronasally. It comes in the palate and it comes usually afterwards. So you'll taste a wine and swallow it, or you taste a wine and spit it out, and then you get it. Right. And so again, it tends to be related to, I think, to mouth pH, but it's still not totally clear exactly what triggers it, who has what receptors. It just, none of this research has really been done.
Is there a benchmark for people who wanted to go out and find out?
There isn't, and that's the difficulty. I mean, so if wine is corked, if wine is TCA, you can like, that's TCA. Right. You know, people have varying sensitivities to it, but you can identify it. Whereas mouse, I mean, someone who can identify mouse can be like, that's a mousy wine. But you will inevitably, if you serve it to 10 people, there will be maybe 3 of them or 4 of them who just, it's not because they can't recognize it, it's because they literally can't taste it.
Huh. Oh, they live in ignorance.
And so, I guess it must be lovely, but on the other hand, right, it's difficult because how do you, you know, as a professional who in theory, I mean, this, you know, the open capitalist market will solve all things, but as a professional whose job it is to choose wines to resell to people, if you can't identify this thing that many people find disgusting,
right,
that's a liability.
It's problematic.
Yeah.
As we've learned in previous discussions in here, Japanese, apparently this is a coveted...
They love it. They love mousiness, which is why when you mentioned that the early bottlings in spring is like, well, a lot of early sakes, nama sakes, are bottled in spring. And so I'm guessing there
which
must be...
I have literally never had a mousy sake. I've had this discussion with some of my friends who are sake experts, not so much about mousiness, but about sulfur and flaws, mm-hmm. because... What's interesting to me is if you truly have bought whatever anti-sulfur propaganda is out there and believe that somehow it, you know, your life will be better without it, I'm not even going to touch the many things you will have to stop eating. But if you literally, if you've decided like, I want drinking without sulfur, you should be drinking sake because it is one of the truly naturally preserved beverages. And they pasteurize it often, but they don't. Okay. But they don't add anything to stabilize.
Right, other than on the distilled alcohol that helps stabilize a little bit. Right. But other than that, yeah.
For sure. But if you're having a Chimay, it's like I said, it may be pasteurized, but it is certainly not sulfured, which I think I had never even thought about that, but it is actually really compelling because it doesn't, the chemistry of sake doesn't have anything that would let you believe that there is an innate protection against microbial taint. And yet, I don't know, maybe I've been really lucky. I've never had a mousy sake. I'm saying that without a doubt I'll have one this week. But yeah.
Well, John, we know you have to catch a train and all that. We have just one little last segment that we're going to break into, a little thing we call Rapid Fire.
Rapid Fire.
So these are going to be just a series of questions. We're going to ask you tip of the tongue, first thing that comes to mind. What is your favorite condiment?
Sambal oelek.
Oof. Nice.
What was your last bang bang meal that you've had?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, meals.
Atomix, a week or two ago.
Oh, nice.
In New York.
Last thing you microwaved.
I haven't had a microwave in about 5 years, so couldn't tell you.
We ask that question to the wrong people all the time.
100%.
What do you sing at karaoke?
It's sort of variable. There's a lot of Hall & Oates.
Oh, nice.
There is some Fabulous sometimes, killing them. Lately, there's been the Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, which slays.
Wow, nice. Amaretto or Midori?
Midori.
Nice.
Name your favorite movie. There's a second question to that.
that's a tricky one.
Name a movie that you tell people is your favorite, and name your actual favorite movie.
It's funny. I don't know that I tell people I have a favorite movie. The two that come to mind are The Insider and Almost Famous.
Ooh, how nice.
Oh, you wrote an article saying that Almost Famous is
the best one movie ever made. Yeah.
I didn't read it, but why is that?
The whole thing is about fandom and this and a world that creates devotion and love, but also is undermined by business and cynicism, and that's why, as well as rock.
Wow. What is your favorite food destination that you travel to?
Again, that's kind of variable because I don't know that I get to go to the food destinations that I would necessarily choose. Paris, of course, which is amazing right now, as we were discussing. That's kind of like a lowball answer.
Right.
LA. Definitely need to get back to Singapore and do a whole lot of eating. And I would say Tokyo.
Nice.
And probably the place that I need to get to that I can shame myself for not is Melbourne.
Oh,
Melbourne.
Yeah.
Okay. What is your deathbed meal?
Tacos.
Mmm.
Beverage?
I don't know. Probably some really good champagne, but I don't know. That's a hard one.
Wait, corn or flour tortilla?
Corn.
Oh, nice. Good question. Yeah. Good follow up. Well, John, we're going to send you off so you can make your train up. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. This is awesome.
Your discussion last night that you're part of was really interesting. We're actually going to put that on the Shift Drink.
Keep an eye out for the, an hour and a half discussion featuring a lot of luminaries.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can read a lot of John's work on punchdrink.com, Punch Magazine. I know I go there quite a bit to reference a lot of recipes.
Big fans.
Quite a bit. And then you also are writing a book.
Yeah.
Yeah. Get it done.
Is this the George R. Martin of the... It's
starting to feel that way. Yeah. New French wine out next year, hopefully.
Awesome.
Asterisk.
Yeah. special thank you for our listeners. We appreciate you coming back to us. Don't forget to throw us a review on iTunes or just give us one star on Yelp. That's all
just
we ask for.
Just one star. Just one star. Not even half a star.
And a special thank you to Jeffrey Lamoureux and our intro music, Mr. DJ Rec Tech, for the hilarious sound effects.
Not next week. We'll have another recording this week.
Somebody stop
Man,
us.
Bang, bang, bang. thanks for listening. Come back soon. You're listening to Shift Drink on Full Service Radio. Thanks, John.
Thank you.